Hello, and welcome to An Englishman in the Balkans. I'm David Bailey, and over the past nearly 12 years, this podcast has taken on many forms, from interviews and audio diaries to cultural snapshots and expat reflections. You might notice some different podcast names mentioned along the way, but it's all part of the same journey, one that explores life, people, and stories from this fascinating region I now call home. If you're enjoying the listen, I'd love it if you left a quick review or rating wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps others discover the show. And if something in the episode sparks your interest or curiosity, why not drop me a message? I always enjoy hearing from listeners. I always reply.
You're listening to An Englishman in the Balkans.
Welcome to An Englishman in the Balkans podcast with me, David Pacinovic Bailey. In this podcast, you'll get a unique look at life in Bosnia and Herzegovina through my eyes, the eyes of an immigrant. Each episode, I share my experiences living in this often misunderstood country and introduce you to some of the interesting people I've met along the way. From exploring the rich culture and history to discussing the challenges and joys of immigrating to a new country, this podcast offers a thoughtful and engaging look at life in the Western Balkans.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. If you would like to support us and the production of future episodes, then please consider maybe giving us a tip or becoming a member of our podcast family. The link to do that is in the show notes for this podcast. Thanks again for listening. We really do appreciate it.
You're listening to An Englishman in the Balkans.
Welcome to An Englishman in the Balkans, the podcast that takes you on a captivating journey into the heart of Bosnia and Herzegovina and the wider Western Balkans. Each episode, we delve into the rich history, vibrant culture, and hidden gems of this beautiful country. Through engaging conversations and personal anecdotes, we aim to bridge the gap between the Balkans and the rest of the world. So sit back, relax, and get ready to be inspired, entertained, and connected.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. If you would like to support us and the production of future episodes, then please consider maybe giving us a tip or becoming a member of our podcast family. The link to do that is in the show notes for this podcast. Thanks again for listening. We really do appreciate it.
An Englishman in the Balkans podcast with David Bailey.
Welcome to this episode of the podcast. And if you're a first-time listener, I'm David Bailey, an Englishman in the Balkans. I've lived in the northwest of Bosnia and Herzegovina for over 20 years. This podcast is all about telling stories from this small, heart-shaped, but often misunderstood country in the Western Balkans. In this episode of the podcast, I catch up with a former colleague that I haven't seen in real life for over 20 years. Martin McNee was a young British military public affairs officer back in 1997 when she came to Gorni Vakuf to run a small mobile media team, documenting the life and experiences of the soldiers she worked with for press use back in the United Kingdom. The memories of her 8 months of being in Bosnia have stayed with her. Martine's insights regarding my adopted home country are very interesting, as I found out during the recording of this podcast.
You're listening to An Englishman in the Balkans.
Hello, it's brilliant to be here, David, and it is about 20 blah years. I'm just a normal person, really. I was a broadcaster and I joined the Army Reserves and I got called up to come to Bosnia in 1996, which was one of the absolute highlights of my life. And we'll go into that later, but I now still work for the Ministry of Defence. I'm no longer in the Reserve Forces, but I did nearly 27 years in it. And I'm the Chief Communications Officer for the MOD for the devolved nations. So that is Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales. And I spend my days promoting what the MOD does in those countries. So that's what I do at the moment, and I'm currently sitting in my house just north of Glasgow, between Cumbernauld and Kirkintilloch, with my cat Dougal on my knee, and I'm really looking forward to this.
Martin, how did you end up? I know that you said you joined the reserve forces, and that's where we met because we were both media officers. But how did you end up serving in Bosnia-Herzegovina in the mid-1990s? What dragged you? What pulled you? What made you come here?
Right. Well, I joined the reserve forces because I lived opposite what it used to be called the Territorial Army years ago. It's a very archaic name, but I lived across the road from a Territorial Army centre, and I wanted to see what it did. And you know, I was quite skint at the time, needed some money, and I thought, yeah, that'll do it. But from that auspicious day when I rocked up not having a clue what it was about, I ended up in the same unit as you, which was a specialist media unit, because I worked at the BBC at the time. As you say, I speak Gaelic, and I worked in the Gaelic medium programmes department. And Bosnia and the Bosnian War and the Balkans War was constantly in the news. It was just pictures, footage, reports that would just break your heart. And I'm not sure the average person in the street would have understood the background to it. It's a very, very complex background. And certainly nobody took sides. Nobody thought, you know, nobody thought one side was more deserving of victory than the other. And basically, everybody just felt heart sorry for everyone. And even more so, given the fact it was so close to home. And quite a lot of people my age would have probably have gone to Yugoslavia for their holidays because it was a really popular tourist destination. So seeing this happen every night in your living room, it was just heartbreaking. And I was offered the chance as a media officer to go over there. And I was coming to the end of my contract at the BBC at the time. And I thought, I have to go and try and do something. I'd heard all about what the UN had done, what NATO was doing, and I joined the IFOR NATO contingent when it was about three quarters of the way through in 1996 as the media officer, first of all in Split in Croatia, and then I was moved up to Gornji Vukov, and I worked with a photographer as a mobile news team. So we were going around everywhere showing people what was happening in places where we probably wouldn't be allowed to take journalists. So some pretty hairy places, so some pretty full-on operations, and some interesting characters met, definitely. So I did that for about 8 months.
What was your typical day like? Because people think, when you talk about militaries, that it's all about weapons and it's all about driving around in tanks. But working in the media side of a military operation is completely and utterly different to the perception that most people had. So there you are as a young officer in a post-conflict environment. And as you said, some pretty hairy situations going on. But what was a typical day like for the young Martin back then?
Well, when I was in Gornji Vukov, which was actually the bit where I had most autonomy, the good thing about it was that there was never such a thing as a typical day. Myself and my photographer, we got to basically plan our own agenda, if you liked. We would be involved in lots of meetings with the units that were nearby. We would keep in contact with we had a point of contact in each military unit to find out what they were doing, what was going on, what would be newsworthy, what people at home would want to hear about both their loved ones serving in the armed forces over there and, generally speaking, what the armed forces were doing if they didn't have anybody in it. So I would plan about a couple of weeks ahead if I could, about where we'd go, what we'd visit. But sometimes, you know, an operation would happen. For example, they'd find an arms cache or something, and they'd be an infantry unit getting sent in before dawn to try and, you know, seize that and on helicopters, and you know, I'd be drafted in to go with them with my photographer. And sometimes there was some quite awful things discovered, for example, mass graves and what have you, and we'd be drafted in to help document that as well, not for the media but for the authorities, you know. So we could have any of that going on. But a normal day would be get up, have breakfast, look at the weather, decide which mode of transport we were going to travel on, whether that be a helicopter, because we were based alongside a regiment of the Army Air Corps, or our trusty Land Rover Defender 90 with all our stuff in the back in case we got stuck somewhere, because the roads then were pretty damaged and bridges were out, and you know, it was the winter tour I did as well, so the weather was pretty unpredictable. And we would arrive at a unit, would go out and do with them whatever they were doing, whether it was engineering, fixing the bridges or building schools, or whether it was the infantry who were doing patrols in the village or town where they were based. We'd go out with them and would just document what they were doing, write it up, take photos of it and send it back to our colleagues at Headquarters Army in the UK. And they had a specific team who dealt with all the stuff we did out in the former Yugoslavia, looked at the best outlets for it in the news in the UK, whether that was national newspapers, whether it was local newspapers about, you know, the young lad who was out, you know, patrolling Bosnia when 6 months ago he was at school, and they would send it out. So as many outlets as possible in the UK got to know what was happening out there. And I felt that that was a really good thing to do, because it showed them the human side of it. You know, you've got the 10 o'clock news side of it, which is showing you explosions here and death and destruction there. But actually what we were doing was on the ground with the soldiers and the public, members of the public, and showed the interaction between them and how things were improving slowly but surely all across the area we had, which was the Gornji-Vukov area and north.
You're listening to An Englishman in the Balkans.
You mentioned about going out and not knowing, you know, what was going to happen that day until you got your briefing, and you mentioned about seeing some pretty unpleasant things. After all these years, do you still have recalls about seeing that? I mean, as a young lady officer, it must be pretty shocking, as it is to a young guy, to be exposed to things that you never thought you would be exposed to. Has that caused any issues at all over the years?
Yeah, I suppose it's caused issues in the fact that I've never stopped thinking about it. I mean, for example, I mentioned having to document things for the International Criminal Court. The unit I was lodged with in Gornji-Vukov, which was called the Green Howards, which no longer exists, but it did then. We were asked to go and help with the discovery of a mass grave near Prijedor, and to document what was in it. And it was quite a lot of military personnel who had been killed, who had been buried there, not very carefully. And some of them were still in their uniforms. You could see what had happened to them quite clearly. And that was pretty harrowing. And that will never leave me, especially since, you know, having them in their uniforms, it just brought home to me that they were exactly the same as what I was. I got up that day and put my uniform on and gone out to work, not knowing what was going to happen. And they had done as well. They got up, put their uniform on, gone out to work, didn't know it was going to be their last day, and they didn't know they were going to end that day in a grave with all their colleagues. And that really did, not during the excavation of it, because you just get on with your job, but afterwards, when you sit and think about it, you think, how could that actually happen? And that was happening all over the place. It happened all over the place for years. I had some really good interpreters that I worked with, some really clever women who I hope have gone on to great things, who were telling me stories about what had gone on, about atrocities that had happened, where they had come from, how they'd had to run for days on their own, aged 12, to try and get away from people who wanted to do them harm. I was always invited into people's houses for hospitality. I found everybody in Bosnia was the most hospitable people ever, and got stories about what it was like actually being on the front line in Gornji-Vukov and not being able to stand up, or else you could get shot through your window, food shortages, having to queue, starvation, you know, having to run. I think the biggest thing I noticed was the fact that people had to basically flee with what they could carry. And even what they could carry became too much, so it was dumped at the side of the roads. And constantly you could see at the side of the roads there was belongings, people's belongings just left there, things they thought they would need and but still couldn't carry. So that stays with me quite a lot as well. It's just the sense of terror that people had to just run for their lives, literally. So that does stay with me. Although it hasn't caused me any issues, it's caused me great sadness. And anything that shows me the improvement in people's lives from that brings me great pleasure and joy, really.
You were saying about even in times of stress and times of serious unhappiness that there was while you were here in the country. You mentioned something that, yes, the country is exceedingly famous for, and that is hospitality. You cannot come in for a cup of tea or a cup of coffee. You have to come in and get the full Monty of food and everything. Without giving too many secrets away, I know that you are not a meat eater. This country is a meat eater's paradise on steroids. How did you cope then with a country that is not, it is now, but back then definitely wouldn't have been a vegetarian environment?
It wasn't a complete vegetarian then, but I didn't eat much meat at all. But being in the army, you couldn't really be in a vegetarian in the army either, because they just didn't cater for it. They just thought you were being a wimp and, you know, go and eat a steak. So I had to kind of get around it by eating a lot of chips in the cookout, you know. But you can't live on chips, so I tried my best, but had to eat some. But do you know what I found? That round about the Gore of Cuvadia, which is where I was mostly invited to social events, people were very short on food. It was still costing like several marks, you know, probably about 10 Deutsche Marks for a tiny bit of flour, or, you know, a little bit of cheese or whatever they could get, whatever they could sell that they weren't using themselves from their small farms and things. And you couldn't really buy much. The shops were bare, and that really saddened me. But what actually made a massive impression on me was that every time you went to somebody's house, whatever they had, they gave you. And you know, the immediate thing you think is, no, I won't eat that because you need it. But that would be incredibly rude. So you take pleasure in eating whatever is there and sharing it with them, which was absolutely astounding to me, given the amount of food shortages there were. But what my favourite thing was it's very like I spent a lot of time in Turkey as well, so it's like börek. It's the flaky pasty phyllo pie with cheese and spinach in it, because there wasn't much in the way of meat anyway. There was lots of that about, and that has been one of my favourite things that I've had, and continues to be one of my favourite things that I've had is cheese spinach phyllo pastry pie. So I always remember that from my time there, and how people went out their way to give it to me.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. If you would like to support us and the production of future episodes, then please consider maybe buying us a coffee.
Well, if you come back, which I hope you will, at some time, and you come and stay with us, I will ensure that you'll have sirenica, which is the cheese pie. I'm not too sure of the one with the spinach, but I personally, my favourite is krompirusha, which is one with potato. So I think the potato and the cheese pies will really give you a flashback, and I'm looking forward to seeing you smile about that. This may not have happened, but did you keep in touch with any of those people that you were working back then, or has time caused that separation? I mean, everybody, when they go on missions abroad, say, we'll keep in touch. And yes, it is meant so very well, and it is meant so much from the heart. But the reality is that over time, life does take over and people do go separate paths. But did you ever keep in touch for very long with any of the locals that you met?
I did for a couple of years with two of the wonderful women who were interpreters. One was a Serbian girl and the other one was a Croatian girl. And, you know, what struck me is that they were both very, very, not just very, very clever, very, very similar, similar mindset, similar ambitions, pretty much the same if, you know, you couldn't tell them apart from being Serbian and Croat. At all, which is another thing that stuck with me in the country as well. Coming in as an outsider, I had no idea the differences between anybody, but somebody there could tell me that's such and such, that's such and such, and that's such and such. I couldn't, which was fine, which we were supposed to be completely neutral, which was great, but I digress. I did keep in touch with two of them for several years, but they both moved to America, which I was delighted about, because Marta, who was the interpreter we worked with down in Split, who came out with us sometimes, she was writing every week to Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton was the person that she wanted to get her into college, who to give her advice and what have you. And she ended up going to college in America. I don't think it had anything to do with Hillary Clinton, but she was absolutely determined that that's what she was going to do. I think she got some sort of international scholarship and ended up going, and I was absolutely delighted for him. And as far as I'm aware, she's still there. I'm not sure where, but I'd love to be back in touch with her, but I'm not sure how to go about that. But what I found from the people that I kept in touch with is their absolute ambition to do something wonderful with their lives. They didn't want to just stay in Bosnia. They wanted to go do something and then come back and make the place better. So I hope they've done that. And that was the overriding impression I got from people who wanted to make something of their lives. I found that lots of the interpreters, they were all women for a fact, and they're all massively clever, and they were all excellent at English. I suppose you have to be if you're an interpreter, but there wasn't anybody I met that wasn't just native level, and they'd all learned it at school and from the TV and from the radio. They didn't have, you know, massive qualifications in interpreting, and they were all fantastic, fantastic people, and it was a pleasure to work with them all.
Yeah, I know what you mean about the English, especially learning English from films and television series. It's really funny. I'll tell you the anecdote when we meet in real life. It's far, far too long to tell on this podcast. But one of the most famous television series ever that is still replayed today, it's Only Fools and Horses. They think that Del Boy is the ultimate entrepreneur. And there is even a pub in Banja Luka called the Peckham Pub. It's adorned with all the posters. Local people, when they learn things off the TV, are amazing. I just want to change tack a little bit. Recently, you completed another university course. I think it is your PhD.
It was my research master's. I've not quite got onto the PhD yet, but it was a research master's.
Okay, so your research master's, and it was based on the Balkans. What was it like to research that, having been somebody physically involved? And what, if anything, changed your attitude towards this particular region and even more so with the country from when you just got off that plane all those years ago in Split, most probably not knowing anything about it? What has changed your perceptions now, having done such detailed research?
Yeah, well, I did the research with Stirling University as part of a master's in research, which thankfully I passed in 2020, late 2020. I was due to come over and see you in summer 2020 as part of that research, but we all know what happened in 2020, so that went out the window. But you helped me massively, and thank you for all the help you put in for that in context setting and what have you. The overriding feeling that I left Bosnia with when I finished my military deployment in the middle of 1997 was the fact that I, from where I was standing, was really dubious about how this country was going to get itself back on its feet. I left after I4 had been in for a year and S4 had been in for about 6 months. There was very little foreign investment. There was still hotspots flaring up of ethnic violence. People were using Bosnia as a kind of a euphemism for somewhere that had failed. You know, for example, when I was growing up, it was if there was somewhere particularly bad, you know, a particularly bad housing estate or something, they'd say that was like, that's like Beirut over there. So, you know, when the Lebanon was kicking off, it was starting to come into the lexicon that, you know, oh, it's a bit like Bosnia over there, you know, as a euphemism for somewhere that was an absolutely terrible state and you wouldn't want to go near it, which saddened me because it is an absolutely stunning, stunning place with, as I've said, lots of people ambitious to do something good for it. But, you know, there was massive unemployment. There was not really any utilities to speak of. Food shortages were still happening. People's businesses had, you know, been annihilated. One of the kitchen porters in our camp had been a lawyer previously, but you know, there was just no call for lawyers, but plenty of call for, you know, general duties personnel in military camps, you know, that kind of a thing. So, you know, that had to all get back on its feet, and I thought that's going to take ages, it's going to take generations. So that's what I left with in my head. Doing the research, I wanted to see the whole research, the premise was that I wanted to see how much the deployment of NATO troops and the deployment of NGOs, non-governmental organizations, had done to improve life in the country from 1995, when the UN handed over to NATO, to 2000. So I had to take a specific time frame, otherwise it would have taken me forever to do, and look at how things had improved. And in that 5 years, it was 4.5 years, I was astounded to find out just what had happened. It had gone from not having anything to the amount of input that the international community had put in, actually having semblance of a health service. It had utilities, it had communications, the roads were getting better, the education service was much better. They even had a nascent mail service, you know, which at that time was quite important. And I looked at it in my conclusion about what it was like today. And today it's gone from basically not even having enough of an economy to feature on any international economic league tables to actually being a high medium income country with massive external investment and looking to be part of the Schengen community. I couldn't have fathomed that when I left. I saw a country that it was still rubble and people were, you know, displaced all over the place. And I think a lot of that has been because of what the international community has done. But I also think that that's a lot of what the Bosnian people have done. And it's a huge credit to them that so many of those who were displaced have come back and have tried to improve it and have succeeded in improving it. It is not perfect. No country is perfect. There are lots of things going on that you wouldn't want to go on. But compared to what it was like when I left to go on the plane in Split, where I thought it was particularly hopeless, it is phenomenal. And your videos and podcasts show us what life is like there. And it's like any other European country, as far as I can see. You know, one that I would go on holiday to when previously, you know, you wouldn't have thought that. So it's amazing. I'm absolutely thrilled to bits and very proud of everything.
You're listening to an Englishman in the Balkans.
Well, the tourism is now starting to grow slowly but surely, and, you know, fingers crossed. I picked up on what you were saying about education and also health. Two years ago, I think it is now, I broke my ankle quite seriously and went into a local hospital. Admittedly, it had only been opened less than 2 years, but the service that I experienced, the quality of care was second to none. And when I went back to visit my daughter that is still in the UK, we were discussing that. And yeah, it hit me quite hard, actually, that, you know, perceptions don't necessarily become reality, that there is this phrase now when perception becomes reality. And the perception of the Bosnian healthcare system was like it's in the dark ages. And I have to say, in some respects, the United Kingdom is not cracking up to be what I grew up to think it was. And the country, as you say, it is coming on. It's not perfect. You also mentioned about whether it's watching the videos and podcasts that I create or other content that you can have access to online, that the country has changed from anything that you could have imagined when you got out of your sleeping bag all those decades ago while you were here. Now that you most probably will be able to travel and come back, this is, I'm putting you on the spot here. What five places or five experiences would you like to deep dive into this time? Because it's going to be a completely different environment, total freedom of movement. Okay, not five. Just give us a couple off the top of your head. What would be the first? If you arrived at my door and said, I need to do this and I need to see or do this now, what would that be?
Well, do you know what it would be? I would like to go a walk in the countryside, because we couldn't do that when I was there because of all the minefields, most of which hadn't actually been identified yet. So we had to stay on tarmac roads the whole time. Here I was in this country, which looked like something out of, you know, Lord of the Rings, Hansel and Gretel, what have you, the most astounding scenery. And we couldn't access most of it. I would love to either go for drives and then walks, or just a walk in the country. I would also like to go into Banja Luka town centre, city centre, because there was nothing open there when I was there. It was a ghost town. And I see from your videos that it's a really buzzy kind of metropolitan area with lots of fun things to do in it. And I'd also like to go to Mostar. Last time I was in Mostar, it was looked after by the Spanish military. We went there for the day. The bridge was hadn't been rebuilt yet, and it had quite severe damage. So I'd like to go back and see what the bridge is like in Mostar. And finally, I'd like to go to Split again. I'd like to go to Diocletian's Palace as well, because I used to have a poster of Diocletian's Palace. I know it's not in Bosnia, but I used to have a poster of it on my wall, because my wall in the old factory in Gornji Vukovar, where we were based, had 50 cal gunfire marks all the way, bullet holes all the way up it. So I used the picture of Diocletian's Palace, a massive big poster of it, which is obviously from a travel agency or something, to cover that, to remind me remind me of holidays in Yugoslavia. So yeah, there's five for you.
When you come, we're going to crack all of those. Finally, I know I'm taking your time on this Sunday, but to finish off, looking back on your time here and your experiences, not only at the time but since, what advice would you give to anybody that is watching or listening to this, who wants to consider going to a country that has issues, let's put it that way, and to help them? You've come, you've helped. I'm sure you've seen some things work, some things fail. And yeah, what advice would you give to anybody? Let's say an early 20s guy or girl that says, I want to get into doing something that helps other people in countries that aren't my own and in countries that are seriously suffering. What couple of granites of advice would you give them?
Oh, it's very kind of you to say that I've come and I've helped. I don't think I help very much, but that's one of the things that you have to remember. A, no country is perfect and they all have issues. But if you want to specifically go to one that has obvious issues, then I'd have a think about the following. I was very lucky in the fact that I got to study international development later on. Before I did my master's, I did a postgraduate diploma in international development. It involved lots of academic study of countries like Somalia and Vietnam, places that had quite fragile governments and security systems and what have you. And it all seems really overwhelming when you go to these countries, or you even look at these countries and think, how could anybody make that better? But what you've got to remember is you might not be able to change the whole world for everybody, but you can change somebody's world by just doing something small or modest. For example, a road into somewhere could be freedom and opportunities for employment for an entire community. So it's not changed the entire political outlook of the country, but it's helped that community. The opening of or just even having a nurse or a medic in a certain community who hasn't had one for ages will vastly improve the health and well-being of that community. So, you know, you've got to look at it as small things. You know, that awful saying, how do you eat an elephant one piece at a time? That's kind of what it is. You can be overwhelmed by the enormity of a country's problems and think it's never going to get any better. But it certainly won't get any better if you think that and don't go there and do anything. So I would say it's a combination of all the small things that we've all done over the last 30 years. Has it been that long? Oh yeah, it has. Over the last 30 years in the Balkans, both people who've come in from the international community and people who've lived there, stayed there, people who've gone away and come back, that have made it what it is today. So it's everybody's little contribution. So I would encourage people who are thinking along the lines of going to assist as an NGO member or a member of the military, the UN, whatever, that's the attitude that you take. Certainly works for me.
Martine, thank you so much. It's been a real insight, especially for me. I think that although I haven't gone native, I hate that phrase with a vengeance, but you know, I see things differently now. Somebody said only the other week, the reason, and we get into discussions about things, obviously, and somebody said, have you heard what you're saying? And I said, well, I think what I'm saying is quite sensible and normal. And they smiled and they said, yeah, but you're like us now. You're not like an international anymore. So, yeah, 20-odd years here is different. I wouldn't be anywhere else in the world. And I still feel that the job that I came to do, which was 2 years, 18 months after you left here, when I arrived here, I still don't think that I completed the task that I came to do. Martine, thanks so much for your time. I hope we didn't annoy Dougal too much, because we have five cats here and they all are vying for attention all the time. Have a nice Sunday, and I really do hope that in 2023 that you get to come here. We can have a blast, and I think that you're to use not a very good phrase in the UK, I think you're going to be totally gobsmacked when you see things on the ground here.
I think so too, and I really look forward to it. Thank you for asking me to be part of this. It's really nice of you.
That's me talking to Martine McNee about her 8 months here in Bosnia back in 1997-98. I hope you found it interesting, and if you did, maybe you might consider subscribing to our blog. The link is in the show notes. Or maybe buying a coffee or two. Thanks in advance. That's it for this episode. We have loads more episodes planned for this year. But in the meantime, please stay safe wherever you are listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.
for listening to our podcast. If you would like to support us and the production of future episodes, then please consider maybe buying us a coffee. The link to do that is in the show notes for this podcast. Thanks again, and see you next time.
And that's a wrap for this podcast. We hope you've enjoyed finding out a little more about both Bosnia and Herzegovina and the wider Western Balkans. If you've enjoyed this journey as much as we enjoy bringing it to you, please take a moment to leave us a review and subscribe to our podcast. Your feedback helps us tremendously and makes a huge difference. Thank you once again for joining us, and we'll see you on the next episode.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. If you would like to support us and the production of future episodes, then please consider maybe giving us a tip or becoming a member of our podcast family. The link to do that is in the show notes for this podcast. Thanks again for listening. We really do appreciate it.
You're listening to An Englishman in the Balkans.
Welcome to An Englishman in the Balkans podcast with me, David Pejcinovic Bailey. In this podcast, you'll get a unique look at life in Bosnia and Herzegovina through my eyes, the eyes of an immigrant. Each episode, I share my experiences living in this often misunderstood country and introduce you to some of the interesting people I've met along the way. From exploring the rich culture and history to discussing the challenges and joys of immigrating to a new country, this podcast offers a thoughtful and engaging look at life in the Western Balkans. So that's it for this one. Thanks for keeping me company. If you enjoyed the episode, maybe share it with a friend who might like it too. And if you've got thoughts, questions, or just want to say hello, you can always reach out. Also, if you'd like to support the podcast and help me keep telling these stories, you can drop a little tip via Buy Me a Coffee. The link is in the show notes. Even a euro or two makes a big difference. So that's it then. Take care, and I'll catch you in the next episode.